Hello and welcome to episode 143 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Valentine, and Chris Weston. Well, I think it's fair to say that there's been easier weeks.
Yeah, it's been a very, very strange week, hasn't it? Since the last... It was last week when we talked to Ewan.
Yes.
And it seems like a long time ago. Lots happened since, hasn't it? You know, the world is a different place. Even though we could see what was coming in terms of the changes around working, and we've already quickly got to tonight's announcement, because of course we record this on a Monday night normally, and it's the 23rd. So we've just had the Prime Minister telling us all not to go out, and so you know that's affected the world in very significant ways, and certainly the UK, but a lot of countries have already got there, haven't they? I suppose
they have. I have been thinking though that actually podcasting in the sort of form that we do it is kind of ideally suited to these times, because we don't really have to leave our house to continue this.
No, that's true. We have been socially distancing for many, many years, and we can do this no matter, you know, as long as the bandwidth stays and the power stays on, we can do this forever. Nobody will be listening, but we can do it.
Exactly. So what has your week been like?
Well, it's been a crap week in many ways, not least because I was pretty unwell most of last week. I've been coughing away sporadically, but I'd not to the point where I thought I didn't have a fever. I didn't think I had the plague, but now Mrs. Weston's down with it, so it might be that I did have it. Who knows? But I was feeling pretty crap, and it's been an illness in the Weston household, but hopefully on the mend. And also, we lost one of our listeners and one of our WhatsApp group, and a friend of mine, Craig McDonald, who sadly died of a heart attack at the weekend, which is a real shock, a real body blow, because he was such a great guy. And far too young, you know, he was about the same age as you and I, far too young to be dropping dead, but that's exactly what he did. So I found that really, really shocking, and I will miss him tremendously. You know, he was a guy with great intelligence and drive and humanity, and those aren't things that you find in the same guy very often, especially not in IT.
No, definitely not. He is actually somebody who has been a great help to me over the last few months as well, with his work at CCS and helping my organisation get up to speed with how to work with the Crown Commercial Service. And very, very shocking to hear about his untimely demise. So this one is for Craig.
Absolutely. Well, he was at the end of the day, Craig had a great sense of humour, and he was very practical. He wouldn't want people moping about, and he would have wanted people to get on with things. And that's what we've been doing, because, of course, one of the things we've also been doing this week is the Remote Work Survival Kit, which lots of people have worked very, very hard on. Not myself, in fact, as it was got toward the end of last week, and I was really feeling quite off the hooks. But we've had people like Don Mason and Paul Eastman, Tom Geraghty, people like Rich Price, lots of people who have been adding stuff. You know, Mark Wilson has done a fantastic job. People have been adding stuff to the document, pulling it through to WordPress for the website, producing PDFs, and the whole thing is gone absolutely gangbusters. And that's a really great thing to see, because part of this social distancing thing, part of this effort to keep people from having to move around is about giving them the tools and the experience to do it. So well done all of those guys too. So yeah, some good stuff and some pretty shitty stuff this week.
There is a strange way in which this social distancing seems to be actually bringing people peculiarly closer together. And these kind of efforts and it much being facilitated by the technology that's increasingly become part of our lives, that I'm certainly talking to people that I haven't spoken to for a while. I'm getting in touch with people. I'm doing the daily global canteen sessions, which I'm having people join that every day. I've run them on weekdays before, other than Fridays, and never had a single person join. So it's, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. I've got to catch up with five of my mates tomorrow night. It is bringing together. Actually, our road as well. We have a WhatsApp group for the entire street now, and all 90 or so houses, more or less, apart from six, are now connected online to be able to communicate and share help and share pictures of their pets, which seems to be the most thing going today, but there we go.
This is social media. Of course it is. They'll be sharing pictures of their tea next.
Yeah, that look, I've got some.
Yeah, that's right. Gloating.
So, yeah. It's also been a week of being able to get my organisation to be remote in very short space of time, and we went from being a very much office-based organisation at the beginning of last week to now, with the exception of some of our key staff who have to be in place in some of the locations where we have homes, everybody's now working at home. And we went, that switch over happened on Wednesday last week. And that's been an interesting learning experience as an organisation that hasn't had the depth of experience of remote working that many others have, and taking people who are little experienced in it. And I think one of the things that I've come to conclusion of is, first of all, audio drivers on PCs are the work of the devil for not ever working quite in the way you expect them to. And also that the user interfaces for most video or web collaboration tools have not been designed with anybody in mind. There are a few notable exceptions to that. I think Hangouts Meet is just about passable, and the only one that people can regularly use without challenge is WhatsApp. But some of them, actually, I did a little user guide how to log into into Zoom if you just want to use the browser so that you don't have to install a plugin. And it's 6 pages of how to be able to click on a link and get into a video call. And it's a combination of bad UI, security settings that mean you have to give permissions for microphones and cameras and all sorts, which is all good, but and it's a miracle that we seem to be actually running quite smoothly with all of our tech at the moment with all these people now working from home.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? Because I think people get into certain habits, and even in my organization, because it's quite a dispersed company, you've got people and teams that are spread all around the globe. You know, you might have security people working in the US, in the UK, and all across Europe and in Southeast Asia, and they don't always work necessarily together in as much as regionally they don't. But even so, even in Europe, where you've got people in Germany and Italy and Spain and UK working with each other, they're used to working remotely as a team, but they're not working from home, right? So that difference between working remotely and talking to your colleagues on Teams or Skype or whatever it is a lot. Or working from home, that seems to be something that's caught a lot of people out, and I think it's because, a bit like you say, they're not used to the environment, or maybe the way they set things up is slightly different. And then when you go elsewhere, you haven't got quite the same kit or whatever. It doesn't take very much to throw you out.
Yeah, and I think there's also something very useful. Every so often, try to explain something that you know really well to somebody who doesn't know it at all. And it's eye opening to be able to actually be able to be looking at things through naive eyes. You see things in a totally different way.
It is. I always remember my time as a, you know, even when I was managing IT teams or managing IT in organisations, and you're doing user support, and my time doing user support back in the late 90s. And at the end of the day, you're on the phone, and back then there was no way, in many cases, to see what was going on the screen. So you just have to close your eyes and imagine what the other person can see and talk them through it step by step. But you have to use the language that they will understand. That's a good learning experience, I would say.
It is. Yeah, no, it is. It was slightly easier because I started in help desk work, and it was slightly easier in the early 90s because still there was quite a lot of stuff that was command prompt based, so things like WordPerfect 5.1. Mm. It was way easier to be able to provide support on the phone in something like WordPerfect than it was where you had a mouse and a pointer.
Yeah.
Because it was far less absolute. So
you could just say press escape a few times and get back to sort of default settings.
Yeah, exactly. Although, have you tried rebooting it? It's still as good advice then as it is now. So, you know. Anyway, tonight or today or whenever you're listening to this show, we have an interview again. We haven't done an interview for a while. So I think we should probably press on.
So, Matt, we have remote working coming out of our ears right now. But you went to speak to somebody for whom remote working isn't quite the novelty it seems to be for everybody else.
Yes, I spent some time talking with a retired academic, a chap called Malcolm Ballantyne, who also happens to be my dad. And it came about because I was in one of the Global Canteen sessions this week. The way the conversation went, it suddenly dawned on me that there's something, or a bunch of things actually, that my dad did in the, particularly in the 80s and early 90s, around early remote working using technology that might be interesting to explore, to be able to think about how it was different then. The technology was very different, but the other side of it, the human side of it, well, we haven't changed that much. And my dad is an interesting chap because he started his career working in engineering as an electronic engineer for the BBC. And then he moved into becoming an organisational psychologist. And it gives him a bit of a skew in terms of his view about these things. So I just asked him, first of all, to talk a little bit about that background.
Well, the engineering part of it's a long time ago now. I left school, like very many people, not being sure what to do. As a very speculative sort of thing, applied to the BBC to join their technical training scheme, got accepted, and was put on to outside broadcasting television. Spent the next 8 years there. And I think the importance of that as I'd see it now is I'd lived through an age, because when I started, the technology I was working with was valves, if you remember valves, glass bottles. And went through retraining to learn how transistors worked. And by the time I finished 8 years later, we were into the first generation of integrated circuits and chips. More important, what I saw through that process was just how much electronics was going to change the work that I and my colleagues were doing. So by that time, I decided what I wanted to do with my life. Went as a mature student to study psychology, came out with a psychology degree at the end. And with that combination of experience, was lucky enough to get a job working for the British Steel Corporation, their corporate engineering laboratories in the human factors section. And there we were looking at the effects of automation on people's working lives in the steel industry. That, alas, only lasted 2 years. Although I was employed by the Steel Corporation, the money actually came from the European Steel and Coal Community, the part of the European Union that everyone's forgotten these days. The project came to an end and I had to look for a job. And through sheer luck, got myself a job as a lecturer at Birkbeck College in the University of London, which was quite awe-inspiring because I'd never even thought about teaching, let alone at university level before, but there I was.
Birkbeck's somewhat different from most higher education establishments, certainly was at the time.
It's almost unique. It was founded in 1823 by Dr. George Birkbeck as the London Mechanics Institution, became a full college of the University of London about just under 100 years ago from now, awards full University of London degrees, and yet is almost uniquely in the country for part-time students only. And the department I was in, which was the Department of Occupational Psychology, it was master's degrees and research degrees only. The average age of the students was 37, which is a good bit older than I was. And most of them came from fairly senior jobs in business and industry, which is a bit scary to start, but they were very sympathetic towards me and told me that I shouldn't worry about it and that they were learning from the experience that I'd had. And it, in the end, worked out rather well.
So most of the people that you were working with on their master's courses were full-time working?
Oh, yes. It was that wasn't quite true, but almost all of them were in full-time jobs. Like all Birkbeck students, they came for lectures at 6 o'clock in the evening, 6 o'clock till 9 o'clock in the evening.
So in the 80s, from my memory as a child, you seem to acquire responsibility for running IT for the department as well as...
I don't think that's altogether true, because there was a very helpful IT support group. And they were the people who, more than anybody else, kept our IT going. But very soon, I realised I'd been taken on as a psychologist to teach on these degrees, which were in occupational psychology and organisational behaviour, to try to give some sort of insight into the future of work and how technology was going to change this. And you can't do that really without paying some attention to technological change.
And I mean, the things I remember as a kid were early word processors. I remember you having early audio conferencing devices at home. So there's a thing that I seem to remember from British Telecom that looked like something out of 2001, sort of obelisk thing that would sit in the middle of a table.
It was brilliant, actually. Years later, I remember talking to someone from British Telecom about this ancient machine. And he said, well, they're a bit smaller today, but there are none better. It was, I think to explain that, it's probably worth talking about some of the projects I worked on. And it was all serendipity. It all happened by chance. And I'll mention three projects. I'll come on to the audio one as the second, if I may. The first was not altogether out of the blue, but I certainly didn't anticipate it. I was invited to join a project which, in fact, had an enormous amount of influence on me and the way that I saw the world. The project was financed and run for the British Library. And the project was to try to replicate all of the processes of the production of an academic journal completely online. Now, when I say online, to begin with, fortunately, it changed fairly rapidly. To begin with, the means we had of entering and printing out information into the mini-computer which was running all this was an ASR33 teletype, which had to be loaded with paper. And everything I typed in appeared on the roll of paper, and everything that came back was on the roll of paper. But the software included two principal things. Firstly, I had access to email for the first time. If you can imagine email on paper, then you'll have some idea of how long ago all of this was. But the other thing was it had, for the time, and I think even to this day, a fairly sophisticated computer conferencing system, a system called Notepad. And it was that we used, the combination of email and the computer conferencing system, with the ability, in fact, to upload and download text files, which was the basis of producing a scientific journal. And I believe a few editions actually came out, but it was a lot more difficult than we thought it was going to be. So that was the first project. A few years later, that project started in 1979, lasted for 3 years to 1982. There weren't very many people in 1979 who were using email. A little bit later, around about 1984, 1985, again out of the blue, I might be wrong, but I think it was probably the fact that some of my students worked for British Telecom. And I was approached by somebody in British Telecom asking if I would do a project for them investigating the use of audio conferencing in higher education. And that's where the conference units that you referred to a few moments ago came from. We did quite a few things with that, varying success. I'll just mention one because it was outstandingly successful. And I managed to involve the Royal Veterinary College. They were very interested because they realised they had a significant problem with the continuing professional development of vets, particularly in remote areas. And they ran over a period of some years a project in which they used audio conferencing to run seminars for CPD. And I think the most significant thing about this, it got vets in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland to talk to other vets about current veterinary problems, where previously they would go for months, if not longer, without the opportunity to talk to someone from their own profession. The other thing I'd mention about that is they devised a very sophisticated, for the time, process in which they prepared slides on 35mm slides and posted them out to all the vets, each of whom had a carousel projector. And it wasn't just talking over the audio conferencing link, it was a matter of working through the slides and discussing what was there. It was marvellous stuff. So that was the first project. Second project was one in which we, again from British Telecom, but this time in combination with the central office of the University of London, the Office for the Vice-Chancellor and Principal, we looked at the possibilities of using video conferencing to connect the various colleges of the university. Here, the underlying problem was that London, and we read about similar problems in the United States, the colleges of the university appear to be so close together, but in fact, they are short distance, high frustration journeys if you want to get from one college to another. Setting up things like seminars to involve more than one college was in fact quite difficult. For an hour and a half seminar, you'd write off the best part of a day. So what the attempt was to link the colleges through video links. And there, and now remember, this was started in 1985 and it went on to about 1989. British Telecom gave us our own private fibre optic network. So we're going back some years. Fibre optics has been around for longer than most people would imagine. And we connected the central London colleges, UCL, King's, Birkbeck, and some of the ones which are a little bit further away, like Imperial College in Kensington, South Kensington, and Queen Mary College in the east of London at Mile End, with places I didn't realise existed before. The Royal Veterinary College, which the main building for which was at King's Cross, has a farm at Potter's Bar. There was in those days a University of London Agricultural College, Y College, which was in rural Kent. The Royal Holloway College at Egham, well to the west of Heathrow. And all of these we were able to include. I think the enduring memory there, now you must remember it was the 1980s, it was just tacitly assumed that men would be more interested than women. And those men would come from the science departments, not the arts or humanities. So when, after an enormous amount of problem getting anything set up at all, the first successful series of seminars was entirely from women from history departments, people realised things weren't quite what we imagined. So the video conferencing experience was interesting. The third project, which I think from my point of view was the most significant, we can talk more about this if you'd like, I'll just outline it now. For difficult circumstances that Birkbeck found itself in, we realised that in our department we were going to have to double the number of students, to double the fee income, or we would be out of business. And to cut a long story short, the head of the department, Professor Peter Herriot, said, Malcolm, you've been doing all this work with audio conferencing, video conferencing and computer conferencing. I think we should abandon our degree courses as they currently run, and I think we should set up on a distance learning basis. That's what we did. We got funding from two different parts of the Manpower Services Commission, which was an agency of the Department of Employment. The technical development was financed by the, what did they call it? There was an experimental learning part of the MSc. The Psychological Services Division gave us money for curriculum development. And in 1989, with deep breath, we started this new course, which at first was a bit dodgy, to say the least. All I'll add to that for now is the design, I think we must have got right, because I just checked on the web today. That course has not changed in its basic structure one bit. I'm sure the content has, the curriculum has, but the way in which what we called network learning was set up hasn't changed significantly, and they're currently advertising for students to join the October 2020 entry. And the fact that it hasn't changed, I think, is the most significant thing of all, not that we did it in 1989.
So talk just a little bit about the technology that was involved then, because obviously that is from quite a different era now of information technology, pre-internet in terms of domestic internet use, pre-personal computer.
Right, as far as the connection was concerned, yes, there was no internet, but in fact things weren't quite as different as you might imagine, because the internet used to be called the network of networks, and it brought together a lot of pre-existing networks. One of the most significant of those was JANET, the Joint Academic Network, which linked the universities of the country. And we used JANET. So for people who... It was all dial-up, of course, dial-up modems. So what we had to find was... Because the students were all over the country. What we had to find was local universities who would collaborate with us to the extent they would allow us to dial into their pads, their packet assembler, disassemblers, and access the JANET locally for people so they wouldn't run up enormous phone bills. So from that point of view, yes, we had dial-up modems, which for today's standards were terribly clunky. But in terms of network access, it wasn't that different. In terms of the technology, it, of course, was quite different. We bought a Canadian conferencing system for the University of Guelph, which was called COSY, the conferencing system, COSY, COSY, the conferencing system. And we were able to employ a programmer, a full-time programmer, who was able to adapt that to our needs. And we ran it as computer conferencing systems ran in those days, something which I personally miss.
And so this was, what, forum-based?
It was forum. In today's language, it was forum-based. The key difference between email, which we also used, between email and the conferencing system was in email... It's a person-to-person system. One person sends an electronic message to another. You can, of course, send to lists, but really that's multiple one-to-one. It's not really genuine group interaction. Whereas the conferencing system, you didn't send to a person. You picked up on what today would be called a thread. You picked up on a forum topic, that's the term that was used in those days. The topic of conversation, once it got underway, then you had a sequence of contributions to it. So you were adding to the sequence of contributions in a topic thread. I'm mixing the terminology of the different ages there. And it was tremendously successful. A really important aspect of it, though, and I think this above all else, which is what led to its success over the years, we conceived it as essentially extending face-to-face contact. Our argument was students came to Birkbeck for two reasons. They came to get their degrees and learn from it. But the other reason, which was just as important, if not more so, remember, 37 years old was the average age. They came to talk to other people from other organisations in a neutral environment about who were having problems that were very similar to their own. And that was something that happened very much at an informal level. It happened to a certain extent in discussions in the class. It happened as much as anywhere else as at the Marlborough Arms in Torrington Place in the hour or so after the lectures ended. And we realised that we could so easily destroy that. So how to do it? People spread all over the country, able to communicate electronically. The way we did it was to assume the primary means of communication was face-to-face, but people would be able to meet far less often than they would have liked. So the course consisted of face-to-face meetings over long weekends, once a term, three times a year, from Friday evening to Sunday evening. And that's where they got the basis for their informal interaction. And then, apart from the formal coursework, the running of seminars over the computer conferencing network, and doing things like submit and discuss the coursework. On top of that, they were able to keep in touch. And that's what seemed to make it work. I remember having a long discussion around about 1991 with people from the Open University who were also using this sort of technology, and their philosophy was entirely different. The Open University, of course, was founded on the notion of distance learning. There were summer schools, but basically it was distance learning. They had a number of options for doing distance learning, including audio conferencing. They did at that stage much video conferencing. But they were also using computer conferencing, but it was seen to be one medium amongst many. There was no concept of it supporting infrequent but essential face-to-face contact. They simply didn't do that.
The things that you described there sound, they would have looked slightly different because of the advances in graphical user interfaces, but they sound very similar to modern tools like Slack or Teams. And you know, prior to that, there were products like First Class in the 90s that, again, and Lotus Notes, which, you know, this idea of threaded conversations is something that's been with us for a long while. The mixing of being able to get people, I guess, essentially building trust in one another through the informal and through the face-to-face interaction, was that the thing that enabled them to be able to use?
Trust is key. This came some years later after I'd left Birkbeck. I spent the latter part of my career quite a bit of time working with the civil service through the National School of Government, which was part of the Cabinet Office. And that brought me into contact with senior civil servants. And I had lots of conversations, interestingly informal conversations of the type I was talking about that our Birkbeck students had, about their use, particularly of video conferencing. And it became clear to me that trust is absolutely key. I'll mention one example there. I remember having a conversation with somebody, a senior civil servant at senior level, was working in the Northern Ireland office and based in London, who was regularly making trips to Belfast for meetings, but also making quite a bit of use of video conferencing. And I asked him the question, what is it that enables you to make the decision whether to hold a video conference or whether to get on the next flight to Belfast? And he said, without hesitating, it's imagining who might be just out of shot. And I thought that told worlds about the nature of trust in meetings and how video conferencing, it's not immediately apparent, video conferencing puts trust into a completely different arena. You don't know who's there. You can't see listening. You don't know who might be able to get into the circuit and observe. Whereas if you're in a room which you're fairly sure is secure, you can talk in the utmost confidence. So trust is absolutely key to success in any of these media.
With the technologies in the 80s when you were doing the stuff at Birkbeck, I think organisations at this moment are suddenly finding the breadth of skill and capability that people have in remote working and using the technologies. Presumably, you know, back in the late 80s when we hadn't quite seen the complete kind of computerisation of the office yet. It was on its way, but not everybody had a machine on every desk. Were there significant technical barriers to people being able to get involved in this?
That's an interesting question. They had to learn a whole new load of skills which were very unfamiliar to them. Now, the reason I think that's an interesting question, reflecting for a moment, is in those days, most people coming onto the network learning course, the distance learning course at Birkbeck, most of them probably would never have used a word processor or a PC before. They may have had them in the office, but that was right at the beginning. It was the days where middle and senior managers still had a typist to do their typing for them. So they would have been unfamiliar with the technology. They'd have to get used to the technology, a technology they'd never encountered before. Now today, People will be familiar with the technology. But in that sort of environment, probably their experience would be of using it in a rather different way to the way they'd be required to use it at work or on the Birkbeck course. So I don't know.
Yeah, because there are certain models about the way, and this is something that I think lots of people have been seeing in the last week or so, as many organisations have become entirely remote because of the current circumstance, and that people's working practices are actually in many ways still tied around the idea of the physical meeting, the being in the same physical space.
Well, I'd say two things there. First of all, absolutely right. But the other thing is, I say this with some hesitation, but I think it's true. Remember, for 50 years now, I've been a psychologist, not a technical person. And particularly at the time that I was working with the National School of Government, where I was working with other organisations in the private sector, a great deal of the work that I was doing was based on the assumption that actually, never mind the technology, simply face-to-face, they weren't terribly good at doing these things. I ran countless courses at the National School of Government with titles like Effective Meetings and Chairing Meetings and Influencing and Persuasion Skills. And it didn't take me very long to realise that most managers, in fact, are not very good at these things face to face. Add a different medium that they've got to contend with, and things become quite tricky for them. I'll give you an example. Audio conferencing in particular, the skills of running a good audio conference depend absolutely on the skills of the person chairing it. The skills which are necessary to chair an audio conference basically are no different to the skills of chairing a face-to-face meeting. But the way in which you use them is rather different. In an audio conference where you can't see each other, you should be, to use the management training terms, you should be using far more bringing in than shutting out. You should be ensuring that people have the opportunity to speak when they want. You should have the wit to realise when someone is talking too much. And what we always used to say was, sometimes you just simply have to say, as the chair of the meeting, shut up. But a far more effective way of doing it is to bring somebody else into the meeting so that the talkative person doesn't have the minutes to enable them to dominate. Now, these are the skills of running face-to-face meetings. Doing it when you can't see people, you have to much more consciously say, Jim, you haven't said anything for the last few minutes. Is there anything you want to contribute? Which you might do in a face-to-face meeting, but you certainly need to do in an audio conference. You might need to do in a video conference, because everything is changed. And I'd say that these things, in fact, are far more important than the technical issues.
That's interesting. And also that for the sorts of bureaucratic meetings where there is chair, the chair is also a position of power. But what you've just described is actually much more facilitative. So you end up with this conflict there, potentially.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. To say the chair in an electronic meeting, be it audio, video, or indeed computer conferencing, must be much more of a facilitative role. That's absolutely right. But one could look at it from the perspective of a process consultant who I've worked as a process consultant, brought into an organisation where it's plain that meetings aren't working for some reason or another. And it's almost always down to tacit matters, things which people are only vaguely aware of or not aware of at all, to do with power relations within the group. The American expert on these matters, Ed Schein, refers to this as, for the purposes of consultancy, the consultant needs to be aware of who's doing what to who. And people in the meetings often are completely unaware of these matters, but it mightily disrupts what's going on. And once again, these things exist in face-to-face meetings, they exist in audio and video conferences, but they change. The medium changes the nature of them.
We're coming back to your point, if actually the way in which people do stuff face to face, and it's interesting, in the last 10 years, I think that we, when I was in the sort of management training game, as we all inevitably become our parents for a while at least, but when I was doing it, I think in the early 2000s, it was a kind of the height of in-person, quite expensive management training. And I think that one of the other things that technology has done is actually stripped a lot of that out, as we now have online learnings used as a noun, which just upsets me so much. And so that those skills, you've got a new wave of managers now who don't go on the week-long management training programs that certainly I was sent on when I was working at the BBC and at Reuters. And that kind of, you know, the fundamentals of what it is to be a manager and a leader, I do question whether those are actually being taught at the moment in many organisations in the way in which they need to, which again is in face-to-face rather than in...
Well, we always realised the week-long course could be done in a day and a half. But once again, the people who allowed them to last for a week realised, well, I suppose to a certain extent, it's that informal contact with people. Civil service is a good example, where you get a group of people together on a civil service open course, and you might have 12 people on the course. That was a typical size. They might come from 6 or 7 different departments, but they're all doing similar jobs, and the opportunity to learn in, say, the Home Office, how the Department of Trade and Industry tackled the issues, was immensely valuable for them. And you could justify the week-long course on that basis alone. In many cases, though, I have to say, it's probably also respite. No, not for the people coming on the course, the people they left behind. You know, that old saying. I haven't seen it for years. The notice you used to occasionally see put up in offices that said, "Everyone who works here brings joy. Some when they arrive, other when they leave." And I think on occasions we fulfilled a valuable function in that regard.
So if you think about the situation that organisations are facing at the moment, and I mean, there's so much, you know, goodness only knows what, how, anything. But just in terms of the practicalities of organisations being enforced to become entirely remote in very short space of time, what do you think the sorts of things that they and their managers should be watching out for over the next few weeks as people are suddenly sort of dispersed and dislocated from physical contact?
Well, in terms of taking an organisation which for years has been communicating largely, if not entirely, through face-to-face meetings and memos or emails, and doing it much more, if not exclusively, through some sort of online medium. Well, what I would say is what you'd expect any psychologist to say, which is they've got to realise the nature of the situation. They've got to realise that it's human person-to-person skills which are the key things, that those skills will be changed by the medium they're using, and they must recognise that. And there will be aspects of the technical systems which will make things an awful lot easier for them. But equally, there will be aspects of the technical systems which may, in unexpected ways, make things more difficult for them.
Well, that was interesting, wasn't it? And now we know where you get all of your foibles from, Mr. Ballantyne.
If only I had his hair, that's what I can say.
He hung on to it. I think what it tells us is that actually the need to do this kind of thing has never really gone away. It's always been there. Tools haven't been there, or not the same tools that we have now. But as you said a little bit, I think you said in the lead-in, the human factors are actually very, very similar, aren't they? And how we engage with learning materials and the way that we can work together remotely, even though those have changed, our needs and our expectations are kind of similar, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we've got this massively accelerated experiment going on at the moment. And the thing that I find most interesting about it, especially as you know, working with people who are relatively new to the idea of remote working, which, to be honest, is most people. For those of us who've been doing it for years, it is not novelty. And we've learned a whole bunch of skills and techniques as along the way. And, you know, things like audio conferencing, as Dad was saying, you know, it's been around for decades now. I think there's two sides. The things like, how do you build trust when you don't actually get to be able to see them face to face and have the in-person experience? I think that is definitely a challenge. It's not insurmountable, but it's definitely a challenge. But I also think that the ways in which we currently work in knowledge work, and this is something we've spoken about in the past, we haven't really significantly shifted how we work in offices, despite the leaps and bounds by which the tools have enabled us to be able to work differently in offices. And what we've ended up with is a very early stage of digital change, where we have streamlined things and made certain activities easier to do, which has meant the removal of a swathe of kind of administrative workers. And so everybody now spends all of their time sitting in meetings, in meeting rooms, because it's so easy to organise a meeting because of online, you know, calendars. And I think this big experiment that we're just embarking on now, one of two things will happen. Either we will then try to adapt the methods that were from a previous bureaucratic age into being online, and they will be probably quite unsatisfactory. But that's not because, I mean, one of the other things that, you know, when Dad was talking about how just actually how good are people at meetings and how good are people at managing. And actually, in the 10, 15 years since I was doing management training back in the early 2000s, that has just been decimated as an industry. You don't get sent on week-long management training courses anymore. And those management training courses weren't particularly for the content. And, you know, saying about how they always knew that the content could be delivered in a day and a half, but it wasn't about the day and a half of the content. It was about the 3.5 days of networking and trust building and building, you know, connections across an organization that would never otherwise happen.
Mm.
And how does that stuff happen when you then get into a completely remote environment is really interesting.
That's very true. I mean, even when I did like what, half day or 1 day training courses, when I was at Interserve, for example, the most interesting thing for me was meeting people from different parts of the business, from different functions as well, you know, finance people from that part of the business. And that would be then a contact that I would use several times in the next few months and years, because I'd remembered that person, I knew what they did, and there'd be something would happen, I'd go, ah, I know somebody over there. And then of course one day they move to another company, and then you speak to them again. It's amazing how much those connections hang on, you know, in terms of once you've spent some time learning with people. And you know, you have to do a bit of that, you have to give of yourself a little bit, don't you? People see that when you're learning and sharing stuff, then you do share a bit of vulnerability as well, because you're open to the fact that you don't know something, and that I think that creates good bonds. And that's just because you can move to a slicker way of doing things doesn't mean to say you are going to retain all the value.
Yeah, and it's the cost benefit analysis problem, I think, which is that there's going to be, you know, if I were working for Regis or for WeWork, I'd be terrified. Well, if I was working for WeWork, I'd be terrified about what terrible life choices I'd made. But working for one of those organisations, or people who own, you know, all the insurance companies who own great swathes of office blocks, I'd be really worried if I were there at the moment, because they won't be able to express at the end of this enforced experiment why physical space is so important and getting people together is so important. But the finance directors of those organisations that are currently renting the space will probably just see, why are we throwing this money away?
Mm.
And I don't know, it's going to be fascinating to see how this impacts the way in which people think about the very nature of working and work for a long time to come, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And that doesn't, you know, I think people will go back to wanting to get together. I think it'll be like a release when we can actually once again get back to traveling to meet each other. I think people will desperately want to do that. They'll want to reconnect with people and be face-to-face, but they'll have an alternative that they have lived with for some time that they can use for more day-to-day things. And I think you're right. I think those personal interactions hopefully will become more valuable, and we'll appreciate them more maybe, and we'll value them more. Maybe than some of the meetings that we used to go to, where everybody would be dragged into a room and then all the computers would open because everybody would really wonder why they were there at all. And if it's the end of that, then hallelujah. If it just replaces them with hideous and endless video conference calls that nobody knows why they're there, well, then we haven't really moved on. But it's a start, eh?
It is. And interestingly, it's far less easy to get distracted by your computer and other stuff when you've got full screen video conferencing going on, especially if you haven't got a second screen, than it is actually when you're in a room and you've got your laptop in front of you.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But there's a whole bunch of etiquette and ways of working that are going to grow up, you know? This is going to happen now. People are going to find different ways to do things in a different way that, a bit like, and this analogy has only just occurred to me, so I'm hoping it stands up in the next 20 seconds or so. When there's a thing called Eternal September, which for those people in the Usenet community, in the 90s, I guess, in the sort of early mid-90s refer to. So when Usenet grew up, of course, it was grown up out of the kind of colleges and schools and universities in America and then across the world who had access to Usenet. And when you first signed up to Usenet, and for those of you who are young and callow who don't know what Usenet was, it was basically internet news groups before the World Wide Web, when it was just the internet. You could pretty much get any technical question you want answered on Usenet and news groups, and there were lots of recreational ones as well. And then the World Wide Web came along, and that changed things quite a lot. But Usenet was still going strong. But Usenet had some like netiquette. That was where netiquette came from, right? This is how you behave. Don't ask the same question that might have been asked in this news group before. Don't post all in capitals, all this kind of stuff. And if you didn't follow it, then you'd soon learn, because people would tell you, they'd beat you down until you were a responsible member of the Usenet community. Because even then, if you replied to a long message and you didn't snip out a load of extraneous guff, people would have a go at you because you were making them download more stuff and then they needed a download and they were a dial-up connection and every character had a cost, right? So all of this was kind of, you know, they were there for a reason. And Eternal September is about when AOL launched, because AOL launched on September, and all of the people that suddenly appeared on the internet knew nothing of these rules and cared nothing for these rules and started posting to Usenet. And it was every September when new students arrived, this would happen, yeah. And then they would get beaten down. And then when Usenet turned, when AOL turned up, it was called Eternal September because there was just no end of people and no amount of social sort of pressure could then get the Usenet back to what it was. And I guess we are now going to be in that situation with the fact that everybody's going to be remote working. Everybody's going to be doing these things. And those of us who have worked in remotely for some time, maybe have built up our little ways of working, but this new flood of people who have never done it before, they're going to find their own ways. And they might not be the ways that we've known before, but that's the way it's going to be. So we shouldn't complain about it.
Anyway, thank you very much to Dad for taking the time out to speak to me over the weekend about this, rather than the usual stuff we talk about, which is the dog and the current state of the dog. That's what happens. It was good fun to chat with him about that. So there we go, come to the end of another show. I don't think it's wise or anything other than totally foolhardy to predict what will happen in the next 7 days.
It'll be speculation. So I'm not going to. Just speculation, conjecture. Absolutely. of the wildest kind.
Absolutely. But as I commented on Twitter a few days ago, I hope that your organization's 2020 vision plan is going really well, because I'm sure that you've predicted all of what's going on at the moment. At some point, I think as well, we should have a discussion about business continuity planning. Why bother? or something along those lines. Because well, that would be an interesting chat.
You know, I'd be interested to know, and maybe we can do some research about this in IDC, how many organisations rolled out their business continuity plans in recent times and how many wrote them, because I imagine there's quite a few of the latter.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything key that you want to draw highlight to for the week ahead, though?
On Friday, I'm doing a remote working session with some European CIOs, which will be interesting, and especially given the conversation we've just had. So
how
maybe
many of them can actually log into it?
Yeah, that's right. We'll see, won't we? But that's something I'm doing for work, and I can report back on that next week. We'll see how that goes.
Excellent. Well, take care. And if anybody out there wants to join one of the Global Canteen sessions that I'm running every lunchtime, 1 o'clock London time, on Google Meet, you can find details at stamplondon.co.uk/globalcanteen. It's just people drop in, have a chat, have a cup of coffee, and then disappear off again after half an hour. And it's just quite a nice way to be able to keep some social contact going in these strange times. We'll be back next week. Might have a guest presenter next week. Might not. Who knows? It seems to be quite a lot of time available from people all of a sudden. So could play that to us at our advantage.
That's right. Let's hope we reap the rewards of this ill wind.
Indeed. Till then, see you next week.
Well, thanks for listening, and as always, you can find us on the internet at wb40podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at wb40podcast, and you can join our WhatsApp group if you get in touch with us on Twitter and send us a link. We'll get you on that group. Lord knows we need to support each other at this time. And you can always find us on all good podcast outlets.